It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios, as we do every week, Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Are you sure that I'm actually live at 8:30 on a Saturday morning in the studio, even though I'm here every week?
Well, I use that term loosely.
Yeah, well, oh, by the way, I got a question this week, and I realize I don't think we've ever actually said on the air in the 10-plus years, but that is Leo Kottke that does the introductory music there.
No, we've said it every about once a year.
Oh, have we? Well, in any event, thanks, Leo. It's
lovely.
Fun music, yeah.
So,
good morning.
Good morning. Plenty to cover, but not much local.
Nothing really interesting happened locally this week. I mean, you know, I've been watching local TV news this week, and all I see is murders and fires and stuff. I mean,
car accidents.
Yeah, it's
the usual.
Maybe I just need to be finding different media sources. Who knows?
All right. Well, let's jump to national then. And something
which there was plenty of going on this week.
And something you couldn't miss was the coverage of Foley this week.
Yeah, and it's having some interesting reverberations. Of course, the biggest target right now is Dennis Hastert. And the Republicans have managed this very badly because they violated the first rule of essentially dealing with scandal in Washington, D.C., which is you get it all out immediately and get it over with. Instead, all of these revelations have been dribbling out bit by bit for a week now. And so far, we've gotten reports that Foley went after. There's a former page saying that Foley was after him in the 90s. ABC News has reported that the House leadership and Hastert knew about this as long as 5 years ago and sat on it for that long. Hastert himself was not planning to stand for House Speaker in January again, and that, of course, assumes the Republicans have control of Congress, which I'll get to in a second. But he's under tremendous pressure to resign at this point, even though he's saying so far that he won't do it. But the whole House leadership has been implicated in this, and that does several things. Number one, it decapitates their ability to fundraise in competitive congressional races across the country, including here in Washington State, where Darcy Byrne is running against Dave Reichert. Of course, a photo of Reichert chumming it up with Foley managed to make it onto the national blogs this week. And there have been a number of other Republicans in tight races around the country that have been sort of tarred by their association with Foley over the years, because he was a member of the House leadership himself. At the same time, you've got the phenomenon that the Republicans are really worried about, which is that their socially conservative Christian base, which is so central to their get-out-the-vote efforts, is really disenchanted by this for some reason. I can't imagine why. A few hundred thousand dead in the Middle East doesn't seem to bother them, but, a Republican congressman, lusting after teenage boys does seem to push their buttons, because the Republicans have been using this as a wedge issue for years. So that calls into question one of the only things the Republicans have going for them in midterms next month, which is their much more advanced ability to micro-target and to get out the votes than what the Democrats have been doing lately. So all in all, it's actually a pretty important scandal from the sort of insider politics Washington, D.C. angle. Also, we should mention that Doc Hastings, the somnambulant chair of the House Ethics Committee, this investigation has landed firmly in his lap, and he has ties to Dennis Hastert as well. Hastert has given him money in the past for his reelection campaigns. But the biggest challenge here, I think, for Democrats is just to shut up and let the Republicans implode, because the Republicans were already in trouble because of law-breaking, constitution-shredding, mismanagement of a war, mismanagement of Katrina, et cetera, et cetera. Those need to be the midterm election things, because that is an indication of how they would rule in Congress and the presidency for the next 2 years, not what one guy was doing with congressional pages. It's sort of a dead-end issue, and the White House probably actually kind of happy that the focus hasn't been on Iraq for the last week. It's been on Mark Foley. So we do need to focus on what's important and what's going to be around for a while.
All right. And also this week, the House Intelligence Committee came out.
Speaking of House Republican leadership sitting on unsavory news, the House Intelligence Committee, which is chaired by Peter Hoekstra, the same guy who put out that appallingly partisan and misleading pseudo-national intelligence estimate report on making a case for war against Iran about a month ago. Well, it turns out now, according to Jane Harman, the ranking Democrat on the committee, who's, you know, a pretty conservative Democrat, actually. She has now filed, essentially sent a letter to Hoekstra, which was also released to the media, saying that the Republican leadership of the House Intelligence Committee has for 4 months been sitting on a report detailing the abuses of his House Intelligence Committee membership that Randy Duke Cunningham, the now convicted former congressman from California, perpetrated while he was on that committee. Again, a very damaging report for Republicans that Republicans somehow just haven't seen fit to release to the public. So it's very telling about the, and it ties back in with Hastings again, very telling about how reluctant the Republicans in Congress are to come clean about their own actions.
All right. And also this week, the National Labor Relations Board has made a decision.
Yeah, this we talked about this summer, and it's an ugly, ugly story. It's a series of three cases called Kentucky River, in which the NLRB was hoping to essentially eviscerate the union movement in this country by enabling employers to reclassify virtually any employee that has any kind of supervisory or mentoring or more senior role over coworkers as a supervisor. And of course, under Taft-Hartley, supervisors are not eligible to join a union. We found out about this locally because Virginia Mason stated in a court case in June that they wanted to reclassify all 600 of their registered nurses as supervisors so as to win a legal dispute they were having with the union by basically breaking the union. Well, at the time, the AFL-CIO and their organizing director, Stuart Acuff, who actually was on the phone with again yesterday, at the time last summer, they were saying that this could affect up to 8 million union workers and potentially union workers. And, of course, organized labor in this country only has about 12 million people. Well, the decision came down on Tuesday, and according to Stewart, it was probably the worst possible decision. Two of the three cases involved in Kentucky River actually were won by the employees, but the third one, one called Oakwood, it will be the new standard. And it, in fact, enables employers to reclassify everybody as supervisors. It will affect up to 8 million potential or current union members, and we'll see how it plays out. But the remarkable thing about this, aside from the fact that it got virtually no media attention, even though it affects so many people potentially, is that it's also gotten virtually no attention from the Democrats. I mentioned the get out the vote and ground level machinery of the Republicans a moment ago. Well, the Democratic equivalent of that is the unions. They rely very heavily on the unions for their get out the vote, for their fundraising, of course, especially in heavily unionized states or regions like Puget Sound. And for whatever reason, Democrats have not been front and center on this case, even though it's clearly a very political decision. Acuff calls it the worst in the history of the NLRB, the worst labor act of any kind since Taft-Hartley in 1948. And for all that, there's been not only media attention, but the Democrats haven't championed this either. And it's clearly a political decision that's not just aimed at breaking unions. It's also aimed at breaking the infrastructure of the Democratic Party. It's a huge political story that's getting very little play. And I think the organized labor is going to try and fight this on a number of levels, litigating it. If the Democrats can win back control of part of our Congress, they'll try and override it there. There'll probably be more job actions around this and trying to get waivers to that requirement negotiated in new contracts, et cetera. But the damage has been done now. The precedent's been set. It's very bad news.
Well, and the infrastructure of the Democratic Party isn't exactly something that is known for its strength.
Well, it's also changing because, a lot of people I think are aware of this. It's the grassroots of the Democratic Party has, the Democratic congressional leadership has been so estranged from it over the last, 10, 20 years that there's really something of a revolution going on within the Democratic Party between, the progressive blogosphere and grassroots activists service and so forth, and the policies that are actually seen at the national level. And the balance of power within the party is very much changing, and this probably will hasten that process along some.
All right. Well, you mentioned the blogosphere, and that's one of the things that is a bright light in a sea of darkness from corporate media control and the internet. And this week you heard some new developments in terms of net neutrality.
Yeah, I was talking with a friend of mine, Craig Aaron, who works for an outfit called Free Press in D.C., yesterday. And Craig, who I happen to know because he used to be my editor in these Times magazine, his current gig is basically has him as one of the key lobbyists for net neutrality in the communications reform bill that's being trying to be rammed through Congress this session. And he estimates that the telecommunications lobby, which is one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful in Washington, has spent $200 million trying to get this legislation passed that would, in part, create a tiered system for the internet where big users like Microsoft and Google and Amazon and so forth can pay a fee and you get faster access to their sites. Why is that important? Well, because independent media ain't a big player. Their access would be slower, it would be separate and unequal, and you essentially wind up with a lot of people not reading stuff or viewing stuff because it just loads too slowly. And, you know, in the next 5 years, whether you're print or internet or radio or independent video producer, most of the audience is going to be accessing your product online. So it's really a direct assault on freedom of speech and the democratic media movement. And the good news is, according to Craig, that we're winning, that a media democracy movement that barely existed 5 years ago has brought that $200 million lobbying effort to its knees. According to Craig, it doesn't look like that communications bill is going to pass before the midterm election. In fact, he's quite certain of that. It looks like Congress will be very reluctant in a lame duck session to pass it, particularly if Democrats win control of one of the other houses or both. And if they go to January, they have to start all over again with a new communications bill. And at that point, you try and strip out those provisions, maybe keep or attach provisions that are actually pretty good in the bill, like expanding LPFM so Seattle could get some. Yeah, it's really a remarkable victory for a grassroots movement against one of the biggest lobbies in Washington, D.C., and it wouldn't be possible without independent media, because that not only publicized the campaign, but, you know, obviously we're also an affected party, so very, very good news at that end. But he did note also that while Murray Cantwell, to her credit, has come out in favor of net neutrality, there has been no public position taken one way or the other by Patty Murray. So, you know, if you feel strongly about the issue, give her office a ring and let her know what you think.
All right. Well, we're always hearing about free trade and the benefits thereof in the corporate media, and it's looking like the U.S. is currently in negotiations with another country for that?
Oh, no. The negotiations are over. The trade has been inked, and this is something that Republicans would like to ram through during a lame duck session after the election, is PUFTA. Yeah, it does sound like a Monty Python skit, to be sure, but we have a very important piece of legislation. We call it PUFTA! But it is actually the Peruvian-United States Free Trade Agreement, namely expanding the free trade zone that they're trying to get in as many Latin American countries as possible before they all get overtaken by leftist governments. And Peru is the latest that they've strong-armed into this. And the Senate needs to consider that, and they're going to try and do it during the lame duck session. So again, a good thing to contact Senator Cantwell, who of course generally tends to be pro-free trade, and Senator Murray, whose record on that is mixed at best, and ask them to not only vote against PUFTA, but work actively to try and stop it, because the last thing we need is yet another one of these agreements.
All right. And
it's the last thing that people of Peru need either, to be honest.
under the idea that fences make good neighbors, apparently the U.S. is interested in putting one across the U.S.-Mexico border.
Yeah, we want to be good neighbors with Mexico. Of course, Mexico objected strongly to this. Even the conservative Mexican government objected strongly to this fence. But Congress passed last week, and Bush signed into law a provision spending $1.2 billion on 700 miles of fence along the Mexican border. It's a 1,900-mile border, but they're going to try and put it up in the high traffic areas where they think a lot of people are crossing. This is just a ridiculous provision for a number of reasons. The phenomenon that if you have a 50-foot wall, somebody will build a 51-foot ladder. The fact that a lot of people come into this country overstaying visas, it's not just walking across the desert, et cetera, et cetera. It's not going to be effective. They picked one of the most expensive, the least effective, and also in many ways one of the most xenophobically inspired bits of the immigration debate to actually enact into law. And you will notice that President Bush signed this. He didn't get any of the things that he wanted, like a guest worker program or any kind of provision for amnesty for people already in the country. All that went off the table when push came to shove. He signed the most reactionary piece of the entire debate into law. So it's kind of telling us what came of that whole debate within the Republican Party and what came of all those massive immigration rallies last spring.
All right. Jack Abramoff update.
Yeah. A woman whose name most people don't know, Susan Ralston. Remember it because up until this week, she was a personal assistant to President Bush. Namely, she worked for Karl Rove. Her previous gig, however, she was the personal assistant to or personal secretary to Jack Abramoff. And she was the go-between that helped Abramoff get access to the White House, particularly through Karl Rove's office. And now that all that is coming, sort of coming unglued, and federal prosecutors are looking into the White House connections between, Abramoff and White House aides and Rove and President Bush, two things have happened this week. One is that the judge in Florida, who has been allowing Abramoff to cooperate with the federal probe, finally said that's it. It's been long enough. Abramoff has to go to prison. He sent him off to prison to begin his sentence, even though the Justice Department, which is leading the investigation, and which of course is headed by Republicans, didn't want Abramoff to go to jail because they wanted to try and nail down his cooperation on this investigation. So that was one thing. And the other thing was that Susan Ralston very quietly resigned her post after, spending years at the center of the power structure in Washington, D.C. I'm sure she'll get a nice lobbying gig somewhere. She certainly knows the people in that end of the things. But it again, is very telling for just how toxic Jack Abramoff has become to Republicans in D.C.
Okay. Well, we frequently remind people that important news likes to get buried on Friday afternoons.
Yeah, and this week was no different. The outrage of the week buried on Friday afternoon was a Government Accountability Office report, that being the watchdog arm of Congress. That report saying that thousands of people have been detained flying or crossing borders or detained at traffic stops wrongly due to being erroneously listed in the terrorist watch list that administered by the FBI but compiled by any number of different federal agencies and, of course, shared with other countries as well. Some real, real serious horror stories on this. More than 30,000 passengers alone, airline passengers, have asked only one agency, the Transportation Security Administration, to remove their names from the list. Of course, nobody knows how you get on the list, et cetera, et cetera. But that's been it's just been a disaster for the last 5 years. And of course, it's growing and growing. There's something like 100,000 names on that watch list now. And we saw just how easily people can be detained here in Seattle this week, where a man who was speaking Tamil, a language that's very common in India and Sri Lanka and Singapore. Somebody in SeaTac Airport overheard this guy speaking Tamil, complained to airport authorities, and he was detained for several hours and missed his flight because he made the mistake of speaking a foreign language in a public place. It's just that crazy. if you're caught in that situation, what can you do about it? So this is a real serious problem that, again, Congress just has done nothing to address, and certainly the Bush administration hasn't either. There's a lot of people who have been caught up in this web.
All right, and out this week, a couple more indications that there were multiple 9/11 warnings.
Yeah, George Tenet warned Congress in February of 2001 of the dangers of Al-Qaeda. Of course, in the new Bob Woodward book, we have the revelation that Tenet also paid a personal visit to Condoleezza Rice in July to warn her. And this is about a month before the presidential daily briefing that said, you know, Al-Qaeda posed to it. Poised to attack in the United States. He couldn't get Rice's attention. Rice blew him off. That according to Woodward. Meanwhile, there was a new Colin Powell biography that came out this week, and it reports that Powell, in his essentially exit interview with George Bush as he was outgoing as Secretary of State in January of 2005, Bush's second term, warned Bush specifically of all the different dangers that the administration was getting itself into with respect to prosecuting the war in Iraq. And of course, Bush blew him off, and we know how well that's worked out too.
All right. Jumping to international, things appear to be heating up in Oaxaca.
Yeah, I haven't talked about it much on this program, but Oaxaca in southern Mexico, there's been an occupation, basically, of the downtown Zacala Plaza that grew out of a sit-in by a teacher strike a few months ago. It's become this mass movement where, you know, thousands of people are literally camped out in the city, and it looks like that both police and paramilitary forces are poised to attack that occupation in Oaxaca. Something very, very important to keep an eye on, especially since Mexico is still very polarized over that presidential election. López Obrador is forming a shadow government. His supporters are still doing civil disobedience in the streets, so things are getting nasty down in Mexico. Thank goodness we're building that wall.
All right, Iran.
More reports this week. I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that there were naval deployments going to the Persian Gulf and off the Iranian coast in preparation for a military attack there, possibly before the midterms. A third nuclear aircraft carrier strike group left the United States this week, this based in San Diego, and their specialty is anti-submarine warfare. This in addition to a group that specializes in mining harbors, and the Eisenhower strike group based out of Norfolk, which is you know, nuclear armed. It's between that and some various other both diplomatic and military preparations paving the way for a potential attack on Iran. It looks like this is something the White House is very much interested in going forward with. And, you know, we had that great rally against the war in Iraq on Thursday this week, but not nearly enough attention is being paid locally or nationally to the prospect of yet another war in Iran.
All right. And moving over to Iraq.
Yeah. Speaking of that, there's a poll by something called VoteVets.org surveying returning vets from Afghanistan and Iraq that says that something astonishing like 63% of those returning vets say the Army and Marine Corps is either overextended or stretched too thin in those wars. And that's before Iran. So it begs the question of where the ground troops going to come from, and you know, where the naval forces going to come from, etc., when Iran invariably strikes back. The other thing that came out of the revelations this week is that it may not be just Iran that's being targeted. The U.S. may be preparing to go to war with Syria as well. Very, very frightening stuff. One other tidbit on Iraq this week, that the health ministry, which of course is controlled by radical Shiites and which actually is responsible for some death squads itself, so it chronically undercounts civilian deaths in Iraq. It came out with the statement that September was a record number of civilian deaths in Iraq, up 42% from August. So the situation there really is circling the drain. It's very, very bad news. I would not want to be in that part of the world right now.
All right. And the UK has got some insights that
perhaps global warming might be a little more than it's being cracked up to be?
Yeah, a report in the British newspaper Independent UK this week that leading British scientists are warning that global warming is even worse than people had previously thought. This is, that, of course, is the same thing we've been hearing for 15 years now. But their specific concern was that, actually, whether humanity survives or not, by 2100, which is, 94 years from now, it's when your kids will have kids, one-third of the planet Earth will be desert as a result of global warming. Pretty scary stuff when you consider that humans need fresh water in order to survive. Be plenty of salt water, of course, because the ocean levels will be rising, but fresh water, that's going to be the oil of the 21st century. That's what wars are going to be fought over. That's how it's going to displace and kill millions upon millions upon millions of people.
Well, on that uplifting note...
Yeah, have another cheery Saturday afternoon. I'm glad I could get your day off to a good
start. Tell us, there actually are a bunch of events happening today that people can get involved in.
So. Yeah, if you're upset by any of this, get out and get active. And there's stuff going on today. Down in Tacoma this morning, this is where I'm scurrying after we get off the air, Tacoma Progressive Media Conference being held from 10 to about 3 or so. At the IBEW Hall on South 36th. You go down to Tacoma Mall, hang a right, turn left on 36th, then you're there. I'll be giving the keynote in about an hour and a half or so, but there will also be a number of other very good people there this morning. 5:30 this afternoon, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility is having its annual dinner at South Seattle Community College. Tom Hartman will be the guest there. Of honor. 8 o'clock tonight, yet another progressive radio personality, Jeanine Garofalo, is heading a pretty much an all-star panel on politics and the press. That'll be at Town Hall on one part of their Foolproof series. 7 o'clock tonight, the trial of Donald Rumsfeld, being sponsored by a number of local progressive groups, will be held at Pigott Auditorium on the Seattle University campus. That's about 12th and Cherry, give or take a block. Definitely right off of 12th. Meanwhile, on Monday is the federal holiday for Columbus Day, and the actual celebrated birthday is on Thursday. So, take a moment to remember the, millions of people that Columbus, enslaved and oversaw the rapes and pillaging of and murdered, and the 100 million or so that his quote unquote discovery eventually led to the extermination of, and say a little prayer. And then on Wednesday, we've talked on this program a number of times before about all the various neighborhood groups that have been taking on the Parks Department and the City Hall's very top-down and commercially driven agenda there. There's going to be a public hearing at City Council Chambers on those issues and the future of the Parks Department at 5:30 on Wednesday. So they're going to be having a rally outside City Hall at 4 o'clock Wednesday afternoon, the 11th, and then everybody will march inside and attend the hearing and speak as to their concerns. So please turn out for that.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is a publication that comes out every other week. It's absolutely free of charge. And that's because we don't pay anybody anything, so it's just printing and postage to put it out. You can find it wherever you find free publications, and a lot of the stories of the types that we talk about on this show appear in that paper. You can find it at bookstores and cafes and King County Library System and so forth. You can also find it on the web, not only the current issue, featuring a brand new, really good writer named Maria Tomczyk. And welcome back, Maria. We're very, very glad to have you back. All of our past issues are there too, so it's well worth checking out. It's www.eatthestate.org, and if you want to donate, you want to volunteer, you want to help out with the paper, you have comments, feedbacks, tips, anything like that, we would love to have you all help out. Voicemail for to get in contact with us is area code 206-719-6947.
And I know you're still looking for some long-term people that can commit to distributing the paper.
That's we have a task
to fill.
Yeah, we have several routes where key distributors had to leave us over the summer. Of course, it's all volunteer also. So downtown, Capitol Hill, Ballard, I think, is still available, Queen Anne area. A lot of sort of the very central Seattle neighborhoods. We're doing pretty well in other parts of the city, but if you can help out with any of that, again, www.eatthestate.org or email us at info@eatthestate.org.